Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How often do you think about infrastructure? For most of us, the answer is only when it malfunctions. If you grew up in the developed world, you have probably always had the luxury of taking efficient roads, clean and plentiful water, and 24-hour electricity, TV, and phone service. But as my guest today has learned, the comfort and convenience of modern American existence is the product of a remarkable coalescence of engineering skill, planning, and public investment. Author Scott Hewler's newest book is called On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. Scott, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Most of us are very happy to thank teachers and police officers and soldiers for their services to our communities and our country. Why don't engineers ever make the list?
Well, that's exactly the question I set out to answer here. I didn't know that. And I think the reason is because that infrastructure is so infra. It's so below. It's so secret that you just don't notice it. As the people of the streets department told me, you know, the only time we ever cross anybody's mind is when we have a steamroller out in the middle of the street and they're late to work. And so we're just a problem for them as far as they're concerned. As far as the citizens are concerned, you only, as you said, you only encounter your infrastructure when something is wrong. So when you think the water system, you think, oh, those guys, you know, something's wrong today. I have cloudy water. I have rust in my water. And you're mad at them. So whenever any of these systems cross your mind, it's because you're mad at them or because they raised your prices. So we think about it, we have it completely backwards in my mind.
I thought it was really interesting that it came as almost a surprise to you before you started this project that the grid is a real thing. We talk about this in almost figurative terms.
Yeah, absolutely right. When I moved to Raleigh from Philadelphia, one of the editors at a paper I used to work at said, you know, you're going to find everything's different. Here, everything's fallen down, and all of the public debate is about how to keep it up. There, they're building everything, and you're going to have completely different public debates. And when I moved down here, he was exactly right, and I found that if you drove out to the edge of the city, which wasn't very far at that point for a small city like Raleigh, you would see what I came to think of as the bones of the infrastructure sticking out. You'd see trenches where they were putting down wastewater pipes, sewer pipes, or water pipes, or they were burying cables, or they were burying electric lines, or you'd see them paving, and you just realize that underneath that, it's just the earth. But then you put all this stuff in there, and suddenly we have this sort of veneer of civilization that's, you know, in a place like Raleigh, 20 feet deep, maybe, in a place like New York, hundreds of feet deep, but that it all exists and it actually happens. I was in Nashville at one point, and I remember pulling over to the side of the road because a guy was up in a bucket truck doing something on the electrical wires, and I said, well, what are you doing? And he said, well, we are, you know, we're tying a circuit into the grid here. We're tying a new circuit into the grid. And I just stood there. It was this moment where literally where the scales fell from my eyes. And I thought, that's real. That grid that we always talk about, as you said, it actually exists. It's a thing that has function or it doesn't have function, and then you notice it. But it works, and it requires maintenance. And 24 hours a day, somebody is working on it and working on it real hard.
And before the grid existed, a lot of those functions that we take completely for granted as just something that you have because you live in civilization were either undertaken by private property owners or they just didn't happen.
Right, or they were undertaken sometimes by companies, by private companies, which provided its own set of complexities. But think of water, right? You dug a well or you walked down to the river and you carried water back. And that was, people used about 3 to 5 gallons of water per day. That was about what an average family would use, because if you've ever carried around a gallon of water, you know that you don't really want to carry around 2 gallons when you could just carry around one. And so they used a certain amount of water, and they used as much water as it required to keep a person alive, drinking and washing, and that was about that. Now, the average person uses about 100 gallons per day. or more. Some estimates say as much as 150 gallons a day the average American uses. And that's an astonishing thing. That's because you could turn on the faucet and you get all the fresh water that you want to, and it's cheap. It's vanishingly cheap. It's cheap to the point where it almost doesn't cost you anything.
It's like 3 gallons a penny in Raleigh, is that right?
That's exactly right. It's 3 gallons a penny, and I always tell people, so the next time you stop at a drugstore to increase the solid waste problem by getting a little bottle of water, and you spend $1.99 for that water, for, you know, a liter of water, that's, you know, think about that. That's about 600 gallons of water if you'd have turned on your tap at home. And I want people to be aware of that.
And so much of this book is devoted to water, which is a fascinating subject. And it's not just an issue of cleaning and supplying what flows through our taps. First and foremost, we have to deal with everything that falls out of the sky.
Exactly, because who even thinks about that? But the stormwater infrastructure is literally foundational. The first infrastructure really that we know about are fundamentally drains at a place called Mohenjo-Daro in Asia, where they built their buildings out of earth, and the buildings would just kind of melt if it rained a lot. And so then they would build sort of a new city after the old one collapsed. And they finally thought, hey, wait a minute, you guys, let's sort of dig a trench. And then once they were channeling the water away, then they eventually covered the channel, and they had the world's first storm drain, and then the buildings would stand up. And as one of the sewer historians I talked to said, you know, on day one it was a storm drain, and on day two it was a sanitary sewer, because people throw stuff in drains, and they always have and they always will. But that was the foundation, that was the first infrastructure, and Rome was, the Forum was drained by something that's now called the Cloaca Maxima, the enormous drain, that sort of the giant sewer, I guess, would be one way to translate that. And so you could say, and there, you would not be exaggerating at all, that the Roman Empire was founded on a sewer. And because it was a swamp, what is the Forum now, and they dug a drain so that they could have meetings down there. And that's the beginning of the city of Rome as we know it. And it's a storm drain. That's what you need. The first thing you need to do is keep your buildings dry, your feet dry, and your food dry, because otherwise you die and your city falls down. But I didn't even, when I sat down to do this book, the first thing I thought would be, well, okay, start with fresh water. Well, no, you have to start before that. You have to start with staying dry. And what amazed me more than anything else about stormwater is the unimaginable enormous volume of stormwater. I'll give you an example. Raleigh is a city of about 140 square miles because we're a sprawling mess down here. And
we get that around here too.
Yes, I'm sure you do. That's how we are now, and that's one of the things that I learned in studying the infrastructure, was that we have so much work to do because of what we've done in the last 100 years or so. Now we have to undo so much of that because of that sprawl. We can talk about that in a minute. But I did a little bit of math and figured out that an average nothing blah rainy day in Raleigh, which is about a half an inch of rain, if you, instead of letting that rain, you know, run into the storm drains, go down your lawn, do all the things it wants to do, just finding its level, if you caught it all in an enormous bucket and you put a dam north of Buffalo and stopped the Niagara River cold, and then you took this bucket of Raleigh's average boring rainy day, and then you dumped it in the Niagara River, it would keep Niagara Falls going for an hour. And so, you know, you ask the question, well, every time it rains, why do we not drown? And there's two answers. One, because the Earth is very smart, and the Earth used to know what to do. And the second answer is, well, we commonly do almost drown now if we get more than that half inch of rain, because the curb and gutter system that we developed to support our streets and automobiles, especially our automobiles, is ruining our, not just our creeks, but our, you know, so much else. It's ruining our environment, and we have so much work to do to get away from that. And once you start looking at infrastructure, you start asking and answering questions you didn't even know you had.
You repeat a line in the book that someone told you once, which is that a modern suburb is a machine for turning rainwater into garbage. Talk for a minute about how water that rains onto a developed area is different than what falls into, say, undisturbed forest.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing point. One of the people, the hydrologists who I spoke with, gave me some of his research papers, and they talked about how an undisturbed forest, about 12 inches of rain can fall on an undisturbed forest in an hour, and it'll find a way to absorb it, a lot of it. You know, the trees absorb it, a foot or so of leaf litter on the ground will absorb it, and then it'll fall into the ground, and the ground can absorb an awful lot of water. So you can have this so much water absorbed, and then the water does a beautiful thing. It keeps the trees going. It keeps the animals down there growing. It recharges the aquifers and it feeds the rivers. It's part of a cycle, the hydrologic cycle that people talk about. Now, one of my favorite phrases that I ran across in researching this book was one of the stormwater specialists I spoke with said there is now a short circuit in the hydrologic cycle because in our developed suburbs and our developed cities and where we have all these impermeable surfaces, the water doesn't do what it's supposed to do. It doesn't go into the ground because we treat water as not, the greatest gift from the universe that keeps us all, the stuff of life. We treat it as a problem. I can't drive to the mall because there's water in the road. What are you going to do about it? Well, that's easy. We dig storm sewers and we run curbs to keep the water in the street, running down the side of the street, and then we put a hole in the curb so the water goes down into the storm sewer, the storm drain, and the storm drain runs out as fast as it can down to some kind of draw, some kind of creek, and then that runs as fast as it can down into a river, and then that goes down to the ocean. So you've taken this water that should be nourishing your plants and your animals and yourself and your entire ecosystem and your aquifer. You should be drinking that water a few dozen years from now when it makes its way through the earth into the aquifer. You should be pumping it out, or when it makes its way over a year or so into your local stream, you should just be drawing it out and drinking it. But instead, it's salt water in a week. It has made its way. And so it's not just that we're wasting this water, it's that it's not doing its job. It's just like a short circuit in an electrical line, that the problem isn't so much that the electricity is getting back to its source faster, right? That's not really the problem. The problem is you can't make your toast because the toaster isn't working. So the electricity doesn't do its job. And when he said that our current system has created this short circuit in the hydrologic cycle, I thought that was such a powerful statement.
There's also the challenge of reclaiming water after we've used it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Well, reclaiming water after we use it. Right now, you can all but drink the water that comes out of a wastewater treatment facility. It is so close to being potable. They do such an amazing job at cleaning our wastewater. And one of the things to remember is that when people go to work for the wastewater system, whether they're cleaning the pipes or they're working at the treatment station, they all told me this, almost to a person. They said, when I told my friends, my spouse, my parents, I'm going to be working on the wastewater system, they all think I'm going to be waiting around in feces in the worst possible situation, right? But if you think about it, think about that, okay, worst possible situation of what goes into wastewater, even then you're flushing a couple gallons of water down with that. But usually we're talking about showers, we're talking about what comes out of your dishwasher, we're talking about what comes out of your sink. And if the average person uses 100-plus gallons a day, how much of that is really going down the toilet? Very little.
Let me have you stop right there. We're going to take a quick break. Scott Hewler is with us. His new book is called On the Grid. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Scott Hewler. His newest book is called On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You were talking earlier, Scott, about how very clean, ultimately, we're able to get wastewater. But the bane of the existence of the wastewater treatment folks in Raleigh and probably a lot of other parts of the country is garbage disposals, of all things.
Yes, that's we've had a wonderful problem with garbage disposals in Raleigh. We had a drought going on, and the city was very slow off the mark in addressing the issues raised by a drought. And then suddenly it crossed their mind that they should get rid of garbage disposals, and they sort of made this sudden law about garbage disposals, and the city went absolutely insane. And then the people backed away, the city council backed away, and the whole thing went away, and we went around this enormous circle, but now we're back with our garbage disposals. But the saddest point about that is that they had an excellent point. A garbage disposal, I keep telling people, it's a lose-lose-lose-lose-lose proposition because it connects to five infrastructure systems, and it affects all of them negatively. First of all, when you're running your garbage disposal, you're pouring fresh water down the drain, right, to keep it running while you're running it. So that's wasting fresh water. You're running electricity. It's not a lot, but it's electricity that you could be doing without. Third, it's taking food waste, much of which could go out in your compost pile, which is good for your soil and takes things out of the solid waste stream, or even could go into the landfill and help generate some nice methane that they're probably going to sell again. Fourth, it can it clogs up the sewer lines. The fats and all the stuff from the food helps clog up the sewer lines, and that's very expensive to fix. And fifth, when the sewer overflows happen, they go right into the stormwater system, and they ruin that, and that takes a huge cleanup thing. So there's five different systems that something like the garbage disposal affects, some tiny little thing that we don't think of for a second that affects all of these different systems. And in the case of the garbage disposal, it affects them all negatively.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak first with Rick in Frisco. Hello, Rick.
Hi. I'm living in a section of Dallas that's maybe 10 years old, but I grew up in East Texas in a town that's about 120 years old. And what I notice is that the difference between the streets is here they're lower than the surrounding land, and they have storm drains that draw the water towards it. But when I go back to my hometown or some older city, I notice the roads are higher than the rest of the ground, so the water doesn't collect there. When did we make that change, and why did we do it?
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question, and we really made the change because of the automobile. The older cities are used to they're built on the sort of the Roman system, which was, we get the term highway from the Romans because they would put all kinds of base, and then they would build the road on top of it. The Romans figured out to crown the road so that the water ran off on either side, and the Romans built ditches, and fundamentally rural people are still building roads in the exact same ways that the Romans did. And look, the reason that Roman roads are still there for us to go visit as tourists is because they were onto something. They knew how it worked. And then you're exactly right that now the water tends to run into the road because the planners wanted it to go into those ditches. They wanted it to go into the curb and then where it could be channeled into the storm drains and then channeled away. So your caller made an excellent observation that that's part of the problem now, is that we're just waking up now to realizing that we started to treat water as a problem. I mean, one of the things that I most wanted this book to do is to wake people up to their surroundings, to look at their infrastructure almost the way they would look at the trees growing in their backyard or the birds that frequent the trees. This is a kind of ecosystem, and you should be aware of what's surrounding you and what's happening around you. And think about it, just like I look at vast tracts of Raleigh where there are no sidewalks. And you have to question yourself, what kind of society builds roads and then makes it impossible for people to walk on those roads? What are you thinking about? Your infrastructure gives you clues to who we were and who we are and who we want to be. And it's the same thing. What kind of people, what are your fundamental assumptions when you can look at the very life-giving water that falls from the sky as not the answer to your prayers, but as a problem to be solved.
How did John McAdam change the world?
John McAdam changed the world by coming up with what we call, what we would now call asphalt paving. He macadamized. People still, you'll still hear that word used sometimes. For some reason, we use it for airfields. I'm not sure why we use it that way.
Tarmac.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Tarmac was tar macadam. He figured out that gravel was the best way to pave a road, and that if you really pushed the gravel down, if you used freshly broken gravel, not tumbled rock, but freshly created gravel, the sharp edges of it, if you pressed the gravel down, it would get tight and it would stay there, and it would form a matrix and a really stable roadway. And then pretty soon people figured out that if you put tar on top of the macadam, on top of the macadamized road, then it would stay in place even better, and then you wouldn't raise the dust that you were raising, and that eventually led to asphalt. An amazing fact about asphalt that I learned is that asphalt is about 95% gravel. And I have laid asphalt. I have stood on the back of those trucks and shoveled that stuff, which is not the world's most pleasant job. And even I thought that, no, those are big nuggets of goop. They're not. They're pieces of gravel covered by a tiny little bit of goop. But when you press it down, it becomes the asphalt that we all know.
I love so many of the nerdy details in this book, and I hope you'll take that as the compliment that I mean it to be. One of the things that I thought was interesting is that engineers who are building roads are even thinking in their use of asphalt about how much noise will be created, which is why we don't have a lot of concrete streets.
Exactly. They're thinking about everything. They are thinking about the difference, you know, about the friction between a tire and the street, and they're thinking about the noise that it's going to create. They are thinking about stopping distances. They are thinking about speeds. They are thinking about so many different things that we don't ever think about. And they think about them constantly, and then we yell at them. We complain about them constantly. And one of the, although I have to say that the best piece of information, and I drew on it basically to make the conclusion of this book, came from a traffic engineer, and I asked him, when you are designing a street or you're thinking about paving a road or, you know, solving a traffic problem, what are the things that are never out of your mind? And I thought he was going to say, well, velocity and stopping distance or mass or pedestrians and motorists or bicyclists or, you know, concrete and asphalt or some bridge carrying weight. And he said two things are never out of my mind: money and political will. And that stopped me in my tracks, as he was quite certain it would, and he was very satisfied when he saw how stunned I was. But he said, this is the reality. And every person I interviewed for this book, and I think I can say that without qualification, every single person I interviewed, from the people who are running electrical utilities to the people who are pulling clogs out of storm drains, said, we face no technical challenges that we can't overcome right now. When we're talking about the smart grid, whatever that is, to some people, a couple of engineers, they were talking about how, well, we just needed to make a couple improvements in battery storage technology and a couple improvements in the way, printed circuits work so that we can, you know, use the higher voltages that we need to run the circuits without exploding them, then the smart grid will be perfect. And I said, well, isn't that like saying that if we just got a couple small advances in human shoulder wing technology, our traffic problems would be solved? And he said, no, funny enough, but no, this is all going to happen in, 5 years, 10 years, it's all going to happen. It's, making better batteries is something that we just do. And, figuring out a way to make our computer chips do what we need them to do, that's something that we know how to do now. They just keep getting better. It's all going to happen. But is anybody going to be willing to pay for it? That's the big question. And I kept telling people while I was researching this book that I didn't want people to look at me like I was Al Gore saying, if you don't screw in curly light bulbs tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, the ice sheet's going to slide off Greenland like snow off a pitched roof and we're all going to drown at the end of the world. And I didn't want to sound like Dick Cheney and just saying, shut up and drive. Either. I wanted to just say, all of this stuff is worth your attention. You must be aware of this. It's almost immoral to know so little about so much of what makes your incredibly easy life possible. But push came to shove, I really had to, at the end, strongly advocate that we need to pay for this stuff. If we want it, if you want to keep drinking fresh water and clean water, and if you want to keep cleaning the water that comes from your house, if you want to keep driving on safe streets, if you want to keep having power every single day, if you want to keep having information pouring out of the internet like pennies from heaven at you, you better get used to the idea of paying for it. And right now, we're just not paying for it.
Is the idea that we want to pay for it once and be done with it?
You know, I wish it were that, because then you could explain to people, you think you paid for it once, but you only paid a down payment.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really the idea that we don't like to pay for anything. Frankly,
it's
I
the
think
American
that's
way.
The problem. Yeah, I truly do. People really seem to understand, to just not understand that this stuff doesn't grow wild. For example, I encountered in this research that it used to be that you were in charge for maintaining the road in front of your property. That was your obligation. And the city, for example, when Raleigh was founded in 1792, one of the first people, one of the first positions they created was the overseer of the public roads. And that person had the authority to knock on your door and say, hey, guess what? It's road day, and you're elected today. You owed the city a certain amount of labor every year to help them maintain their roads. And you could buy your way out of it, or you could send slaves. You had to send two slaves if you were going to send slaves. Even then, I think they understood that slaves were not particularly motivated workers. And that's an amazing thing that I think brings home something that people don't understand. They all stand around and say, those guys who are paving the road, those guys who don't do what I want them to do, look at them, those government people who are treating my water or doing any of these other things, as though it's separate from themselves. But of course, that paving example reminds us that it's us. We're responsible for this. You know, you look in the mirror, that's who's in charge of keeping your water clean. You look in the mirror, that's who's in charge of keeping your roads paved. If you don't like the roads, the situation of the roads, chances are the best way you can improve things is to pull out your wallet. And none of us really like to do that.
So, Scott, you mentioned trash-talking city road crews. Let's talk about trash itself, because it hasn't been that long in this country that we've been able to put our refuse in a can at the curb and have it sort of mysteriously disappear from our homes.
Right. We used to just throw it in the streets, and it mysteriously disappeared by way of roving herds of wild pigs. This is true. This is true. There were herds of pigs that roam most streets. Charles Dickens wrote about them on Broadway, that you would just throw stuff out there and the pigs would gobble it up. Anything that was useful, they would gobble it up. And then one of the nice benefits of that is that occasionally you caught yourself a pig and you had, you know,
trash-fed pork. Yeah.
Right. And it was this amazing thing. It was much closer to what we understand as an ecosystem now. You understood, what I don't want, I throw out, some other creature eats, and eventually I eat that creature, and I win, you know, several ways. But it's only in the early part of the last century, in the early 20th century, that people started figuring out, you know, people have been hauling stuff outside of the city limits and throwing them in dumps since the dawn of time. They find, piles of shells and bones and stuff from, 14,000 years ago or something like that. It's old business, is just throwing stuff away because it stinks and you want to get it somewhere else. But what we now think of as sort of standard trash disposal, which is a sanitary landfill, was only created in the 1920s in California, where they figured out that a good way to cover up trash and get it away from, keep the vermin away and keep the birds away, was to cover it up a little bit at the end of each day with earth. And then the next morning you would clear away some of that earth to reuse, and mostly then just start pouring trash on the top of it. And then that's modern trash disposal instantly. And it works, and it's a great solution. It's not so pleasant because you don't really like the idea of just throwing stuff in a hole for where it will last for geologic time, because that's how it works, that once you cover it up, it kind of stops degrading. You know, we talk about people digging up in trash heaps and finding hot dogs that are all but edible from 70 years ago.
Wow.
Because once you're just burying them in a landfill and really pressing that stuff down and covering it up, it's not like bacteria can get to it. It's not like rainwater falls through and helps it degrade. It's not like the sun beats down on it and helps it fall apart to its constituent parts. But on the other hand, it's also because of the landfills are lined and the landfills are managed and contained, it's not like a lot of the dangerous stuff is leaching out anymore. You know, in new modern landfills built in the last several decades, they're surrounded by, you know, several feet of clay soil that should stop any leaching. They have liners, and I called the chapter on trash the big ravioli, because when they finish a landfill, they put a cover on the top of it, and they kind of weld it all together, so you have this great big sort of like mincemeat pie of trash that will basically never change.
Are we running out of space?
No. No, that was one of the great, remember the trash crisis?
In the 70s and the 80s, sure.
Right. Oh, my God, where are we going to put this stuff? Well, first of all, a lot of the stuff that was carried away from places that were sending it to get buried because they were, you know, where the barges couldn't find a place to drop up their trash. They had left places in the Northeast where they burned their trash anyway. So they just thought it was cheaper to haul it away, which they still do. But it turns out that we still have plenty of spaces to dig holes and throw our junk if we want to. And there are fewer landfills now because of all kinds of regulation, which is absolutely a great thing. But the landfills that they build now are so huge. We just built a landfill down here that's a 25-year landfill for the city of Raleigh. That's
wow.
A lot of space to put trash in.
Scott Hewler is my guest. His new book is called On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Scott Hewler. His newest book is called On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. One of the cool things you learned, and therefore I learned in reading the book, about utility poles was that every one of them contains a lot of information. Can you talk about that?
Yes, there's. I had a guy from the from my electrical utility stand out at the utility pole in front of my house and just read my utility pole to me. So I said, "What is all this stuff?" And there's so much information there, and some of it is sort of pole specific, and some of it is just stuff that you want to know so that you know how to read it. The most interesting thing that I learned about my utility pole was that it wasn't bringing my electrical service to my house, which I should have noticed because the wires didn't go from it to my house. But you just sort of naturally think, oh, there's a utility pole on my lawn. That must be my electrical service. But no, actually, mine went across the street because there's a difference. Who even knew this? There's a difference between transmission lines and distribution lines. And then there's even primary and secondary distribution lines. This was the type of thing that I was finding out and that I was getting real excited about. So that tells you probably more than you need to know about me. But when the guy from the electric utility showed me how the pole works, we sort of started at the ground where there's little holes drilled in it where a service comes out every year or two to check the state of the pole to make sure that it's not rotting in the ground and that it's safe and that it's going to stand up for a while and can keep holding up your wires. And so he showed me where then, after they do their drilling and their testing, that they pound a treated dowel back in there. So he was showing me where I could find that. Then coming up, you find all kinds of numbers tacked onto the pole showing, A, when it's been tested, and then a pole will have a number from whoever owns it. In this case, the pole was owned by the electric utility, so it had two different numbering systems, in fact. It had a distribution number because some distribution lines went on it, and it had a transmission number because it was mainly a transmission pole. And then, of course, you'll also commonly have two or three different numbering schemes because when they change their numbering scheme, they don't come off and peel off the old ones. And then he showed me how to look for the ground wire that comes from the wire at the top, which sort of catches any lightning strikes or any pulses and drains them into the ground. And that runs down the side of the pole. And then the lowest series of wires that you'll find will usually be the telephone wires, the plain old copper wires for your telephone service if you still have, you know, copper wire telephone service. And then above that will be cable, because that's usually fiber optics. And even if it's plain old cable, it's coaxial cable, it's much less affected by the electrical wires. And then at the very top, you'll see the electrical wires. And the distribution will be below, and the topmost wires will be your transmission wires.
And what does it take to knock down? I mean, around here we have a storm, and it seems like a lot of people's power goes out. How are transmitters being struck in those cases, or what happens when the power goes out in a storm?
Usually what happens is a tree falls down. That's usually what happens. A branch falls out of a tree and pulls down a wire. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it goes to circuit breakers on either side, wherever the, you know, whether it's all the way back to a substation or between circuit breakers along the grid, along your distribution grid. Chances are it's just a distribution line because the transmission lines are much higher, so the trees don't fall on them because that would be kind of a crisis. So those are much higher, but the distribution lines are usually low enough that a tree could fall on them, and so then it stops it, and then you've got an area where there's no power between two different fuses, say, that have popped because the wire hit the ground and made that short circuit. And one of the interesting things I found out was that the way the electrical utility finds out where the power's down is it has this very complicated piece of technology called the telephone, and its customers call it and say, hey, my power's out.
So you do have to call when the power goes out.
You do have to call. That's how they learn that the power's out, is you call and tell them. And that's, you know, one of the things that when people talk about smart grid, one of the things they'd like is more communications technology so that you know where electrical power isn't running. But then if you think about it, the way you're going to know that it's not running is because you're not getting a signal from there. So whatever, unless it's wireless technology, it's pretty hard to run a wire and have it communicate that you're out of power when the wire that brings your power is out of power already.
Another thing that I thought about, this last winter we had a huge ice storm and thousands of houses were out and we were out for 3 days. And the idea that the power companies have to prioritize which neighborhoods to go into first, and there's a system for deciding where they go. They don't just run out willy-nilly and start fixing wires.
Right, exactly. Well, one of the ways that I got to learn about that was when we had Hurricane Fran here in Raleigh, mm-hmm. which knocked us completely for a loop. And people were without power for 12 and 16 days and things like that because there was so much down. And I was without power for 18 hours. And I thought, why on earth is that? What made me so lucky? And I realized then for the first time that I was a block and a half from a substation. So they go, first they make sure the transmission grid is okay. Whatever's down in the transmission grid, those are the high voltage wires that wheel power around your entire region and even from region to region. Those are the ones that you see that, you know, have the big scaffolds, the big enormous Eiffel Tower looking pylons that you see out on the highway, and then slightly less high voltage lines you have in your neighborhood. and make sure those are okay. And then they start, once they get substations back up and running, they go from the substation up the conductors, and the further up the branch you are, the longer it takes you to get power. And so I was very close to a substation. My substation was in downtown, so there weren't too many downed trees in that area separating me from the transmission line, and so I was up and running very fast, and I had a lot of people coming to my house to take hot showers. And now one of the interesting things is that nobody was ever out of water, and that's because every one of these utilities, it's the cable, it's the telephone, it's the electric, it's the water, it's the wastewater, they have double and triple backup power plants, and they have tanks full of diesel fuel to run them whenever things go wrong. So they are, the water people love to talk to you about when was the last time your power went out, and when's the last time your cable went out, and when was the last time you didn't have phone service, and they say, when's the last time you didn't have water service? And nobody can ever remember not having water service because they treat it as the public health issue that it is. And even when a hurricane has hit your area, they can usually keep their water treatment plant running to keep you getting water.
I thought it was interesting. You write about the fact Raleigh's sort of college town, and they even have to calculate for weekends when the school empties out and there is less demand than typical for water.
Right. They talk about the Thanksgiving sort of drop in demand, this sort of crash that people used to talk about when everybody was watching the same thing, and back when there weren't so many commercials, they used to talk about the Super Bowl halftime flush, right? Everybody would run out and flush their toilets. And you'll see that dismissed as an urban legend, although I'm not sure that it really is. And because I saw a wonderful graphic coming out of Saskatchewan just after the gold medal hockey game, that after at every period break, there was an enormous spike in water demand. So that was happening. But now hockey is a game very different from football. Football, you spend most of your time standing around and people go to the bathroom. Hockey, not so much. So I think that really happens. Now, in Raleigh, they don't have to deal with something like that. But what they do deal with is that NC State has 30,000 people there, and Raleigh's a place that people move to, not that people move from. So everybody moves here from somewhere else. So come Thanksgiving, all the college students go home, and half of the population goes somewhere else. And they talk about, the guys at the water plant talk about managing the plant so that when your demand goes from the 50 or 60 million gallons per day that you might be using in an average, you know, fall day, that it'll suddenly drop to 30 or 35 million gallons a day because there's nobody there. They have to be really, the plant is designed to run at 40 million gallons a day. So they don't want to run it lower than that, so they have to be draining water towers and draining storage tanks for days leading up to that, so that over the course of the 3 or 4 days that nobody's using the water, they have some place to put the water that they're running so that the plant can keep running effectively. And this is the kind of stuff they're thinking about all the time. And they, one of the greatest pleasures for me of doing this book was asking these people about this stuff and seeing, they would almost be so grateful that somebody wanted to know, because again, they really see the public at its worst, because they see the public when somebody's late for work because they're digging a hole in the street, or they're showing up on somebody's yard and people don't say, "Thank goodness you're here, my electrical service is down." They're just mad because you weren't here a half an hour ago.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Tim in Richardson. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Really interesting program. Two comments, one on electricity, one on water, that I'm hoping your author can answer. And I'm not the only person with both these experiences. One, electricity. In general, I don't think people would mind paying more, like your author suggests, for utilities and services if they didn't feel like they were being constantly conned by utility companies and public utilities. For example, electricity. I have TXU. I use the same amount of electricity all year. I don't have window air conditioning units. I don't have central air. I use overhead ceiling fans, which stay on the same all year, lights, oven, no hot water heater with electricity. Interestingly enough, even though I use the same amount of electricity day in and day out all year, I keep getting bills every year from TXU that go up in the summer and up in the winter, and the difference cannot be accounted for in the difference between how much the electricity actually costs. And when I call them and tell them that I'm using the same amount of electricity, so why is there such a wide variance? I don't have a puddle of electricity in my yard. It's not leaking. They only say, well, we don't know what to tell you. You're apparently just using more electricity sometimes than other times, which I'm the only person who lives here. I know that's not true.
Well, so, appreciate the question. We're almost out of time, so I want to make sure that Scott can respond at least to that portion. Thanks so much for your call. What do you think about that, Scott?
Well, I wish I could respond. I'm flummoxed. I have no answer for that. I think it's a great question, and I think it brings up the point that the utilities need to do a better job of being transparent and letting people know exactly what they're paying for and how they're paying for it. Now, they talk about this. They talk about this to me openly, that suddenly, you know, these are publicly held companies that are responsible to shareholders and stuff, and now everybody's asking them to train their consumers to conserve electricity. And they're like, well, okay, we'll do that, except that we make our money by selling every additional kilowatt hour that we sell. That's our money. So how are we supposed to make our profit? And so they're, I think, just now beginning to realize that the way forward for them is to be more transparent and is to help the customers be part of the way the utility works. And that's, your caller is a great example of when the utilities aren't doing a good job of letting people know how their power works, because his question is a very good question. I wish I could answer it, but I can't.
We've just got about 30 seconds to go, but I wonder if you have changed the way you live after going through all the research and writing this book.
I like to think I'm better at turning things off, and certainly I'm better about managing my water use and stuff like that, but as I tell people all the time, we have a little 2-year-old, and he likes to go spelunking in the trash. And so the trash is over a baby gate, and so I'm holding a dinner dish, and I could step over the baby gate and, you know, try to prop open the trash can lid, and or I could just stand over that beautiful magic hole in the garbage disposal. I have to say, you know, I'm still a convicted garbage disposal user.
The newest book by author Scott Hewler is called On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. Scott, a really fascinating piece of work, fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I had such a nice time.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.